You're listening to the UAV Digest, the weekly audio podcast bringing you coverage of unmanned aerial vehicles and systems. Find us at theuavdigest.com.
Our next speaker comes to us with a great background and a really critical and interesting position here. He's the Assistant Vice Commander of Hancock Field's Air National Guard Base. Of course, that's home to the 174th TAC Wing. I think it's certainly no secret to most of you in the room that the 174th is working really hard to become the first in the nation to successfully integrate its military unmanned aircraft into public airspace by flying its MQ-9 Reapers from Hancock International Airport right here in Syracuse. Colonel Smith assumed his role with the 174th this summer, an important time for the attack wing and for the MQ-9 Reapers. So now we'd like to welcome Colonel Smith here to talk to us a little bit about their mission.
All right. Hi, thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to this forum today. Thank you for the nice introduction. I joined the Air Force in 1989, graduated from the United States Air Force Academy, quickly went off to pilot training, and I've basically been involved with aviation since 1989. The key, though, is that it's all military aviation. So I have a lot of military experience with aviation and how we relate to this. And I'm going to try to pass that on to you, just for your SA, as to the involvement and the advancement of RPAs. As you saw by the title there, I'm the Assistant Vice Wing Commander for Hancock Field. Anybody with some military experience will go, what's that? And I'm still trying to figure that out as well. But really, that means I'm kind of Special Projects Officer for the wing. And one of the a couple of the two major special projects that I'm trying to work on are, as was discussed, flight operations from Hancock Field with the MQ-9, as well as our ground-based sense and avoid initiative. So I'll go over those, but before that, I want to go into a little bit of history. So for an overview, we're going to go over a little bit of the history, what we have done in the past, what we're currently doing, and then some of our future initiatives that we're looking at for 174th and Hancock Field. All right, so we fly the MQ-9 aircraft, and the Air Force term is remotely piloted aircraft. We really do try to stay away from the drone connotation. And we kind of hit on that on the last speaker, Mrs. Ellman, on the, the view of the civilian populace out there of what an RPA is, especially in the military. And I got a story to kind of highlight that. We give a lot of tours out at Hancock Field to try to educate the community on what we do, because it has kind of been a mystery in the past. So we have recently had a group of engineers come out, so highly educated, and we're showing them around, and they take a look at everything, and they go, wow, we didn't know you guys did this. We thought you were just autonomous planes flying around shooting missiles at everybody. And so that's kind of where we're at. So we're trying to educate the community that the way the Air Force operates remotely piloted aircraft is just that, with pilots and a crew. And there's really nothing unmanned about the system that we operate. Just some of the capabilities here. I won't bore you with it, but some of the highlights in yellow are we're modifying the aircraft and we're upgrading to where we're getting an extended range version of it. And that'll keep us up for 27 to 28 hours at a time. So you can see the manning challenges that will happen with that, but it also goes to the capability that exists. So the main reason that the combatant commanders want us overseas is our longevity and our persistence, and is the persistence on the battlefield. Prior, I was a 174th, flew F-16s. Flew over in combat as well. So on the missions over there, we'd get on scene for maybe an hour, and then we'd have to go to the tanker, lose all the SA, come back, and regain our situational awareness of what was going on, and then support the ground commander. In this case, we could just sit overhead and consistently give full mission video as well as talking to the folks on the ground support. So that's kind of what we like and what the combat commander likes and what we provide for them. The biggie there, again, is on the bottom as well, is we provide that ISR, that intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. and close air support to keep those folks on the ground safe. All right, how do we do that? So there's a little bit of background. So the military does this via remote split operations. So this is the cockpit that we'll be flying out of Hancock Field, and it'll be sitting here in Syracuse, New York. Through the cockpit, through a fiber line over to a satellite, it will bounce a signal up to the satellite, and that will then bounce it down to the aircraft that's in theater. So as long as the satellite can see both the satellite dish and the aircraft, we can control it as long as we're tied into it. All right. We do that through a KU signal, which provides its own challenges in the fact that that's a long distance to make all those ones and zeros go through. So there's a bit of delay, and with that delay, we can't take off and land from over here in Hancock Field. So there's a small contingent forward that takes off and lands, and they do that in the C-band regime. They take it off, and basically 5 minutes later, they hand it off to us overseas, and we fly the mission, talking to the ground commander and to all of the rest of the folks, and execute the mission. The big key out of that that everybody wants is that full motion video and all the gathering stuff that we have garnered. And that's distributed through our op cell out through a network node. So anybody with the appropriate permissions can get that feed and can exploit any of that data that's out there. So that's kind of how we operate for our combat operation. All right. Our history is we've been doing this since 2009. All right. And since that, we've flown over 4,000 hours each year. And in fact, in FY14, we flew over 6,400 hours. And this year, we're on pace for 4,700 hours. The key point that we want to get out of this is this: we fly this just like a manned aircraft that's in combat overseas. There's a pilot that talks to the folks on the ground. We go by the same rules of engagement that are required. And we do a exhaustive procedure to mitigate any type of unnecessary damage or civilian casualties. So that's kind of the message we always try to get out to the rest of the community. And I'll wrap that up in a little bit as well. The messaging is very important whenever you're starting up with this, because again, they take a look at this as a drone and we're just shooting missiles everywhere. And even back here in the States, there's that fear that, as was discussed previously, that we're spying on everybody. And that's not the case. So you have to get ahead of that message early and say, this is why we're using it, and explain it to the community so that they do understand and they do trust what you're doing. And that's a challenge, because it's already, there's negative connotations out there. So you have to overcome those. All right. So that's our combat mission. We also have a local mission, so we're fortunate 174th to have a training mission as well, and that keeps lots of folks occupied and employed at Hancock Field and Syracuse specifically. We do that much the same way, but first off, we have a maintenance field training detachment. So they teach all of the Air Force and Air National Guard maintainers how to maintain the MQ-9 system. They basically, the courses range from 3 to 6 weeks. The course lengths are from 9 to 14 weeks. It's 3 to 6 weeks. We have a capacity to train 400 students a year. We've done both active duty, like I said, and reserve. We've also done foreign military. So there's a lot of other countries out there that fly the MQ-9 aircraft as well. And you can see some of them listed there. And we train their maintainers to fix and fly the aircraft there. As of this year, we've graduated 1,283 students and have surpassed 3,200 hours of platform academics. We also have the flying formal training unit, and we've currently put through 32 crews a year. We train both the pilot and the sensor operator. Course length is 9 to 14 weeks, and it is supported by our local flying out of Fort Drum. You can see the hours that we've done it. We since inception, which was in FY12, we have increased our hours and our ability to produce pilots, which is the number one goal of the Air Force at this time, as we see an immense shortage of pilots in the RPA community, mostly due to attrition and retention issues. As such, they've asked us in FY16 to increase our production by 50%, up to 45 students. In order to do that, like we said, we've currently accomplished it with flying out of Fort Drum, what we'll go over, but we're really looking forward to accomplishing that mission out of Syracuse Hancock Field, which will aid us in supporting that requirement. All right, our flying operation out of Fort Drum, that's a Class D airspace, so it's military airspace that sits right next to a restricted area. So, I'll get it here. So here's the main runway that we operate off of. We'll take off and we'll have a visual observer on the ground that will follow us and clear our flight paths as well as the ATC tower until the restricted area, which basically sits about right here. Once we're in restricted airspace, we own separation requirements through the military. We climb on up and then we get into our training airspace. All right. We've had a great partnership with the 10th Mountain Division. They've been a huge help for us in getting our operation, and we like to say that we've helped them as well, because we first started the operations with MQ-9s flying off of Fort Drum, and then shortly after we proved that it was successful and doable, the Army stationed a Gray Eagle squadron up there. So we've helped them out as well. Gray Eagle is basically a smaller version of an MQ-9 off of a diesel engine. All right, but we have a permanent presence up there. Well, we're going to be there forever, or as long as we're flying these, because of the location of the restricted area, which is also an air-to-ground bombing range. And so for us to train to our full missions, we need to employ weapons on it, and we're not going to be able to fly those out of Hancock Field. We know that. So we'll still continue to launch MQ-9s out of there with weapons, drop them on range as required. So as such, we've got two hangars that we're building up there. We've got two 10,000-square-foot hangars that should be finished here in October, and a taxiway is underway right now to connect those two to the airfield. So we're very happy with the facilities and the support we've gotten from Fort Drum. All right, and so once we get there, then this is the training airspace that we operate out of. So here's Fort Drum. So I'll backtrack a little bit. Daily, we send our flight crews and our maintenance crews from Syracuse, drive them up to Fort Drum. They launch the aircraft, and then they land them, and then we drive them back. In order to do that, we have two shifts, and we basically eat up about 3 to 4 hours of work hours just in transportation alone, as well as the risk of driving back and forth, especially in the winter weather, along the Tug Hill Plateau. All right. So, as we said, they take off out of Fort Drum. We go into the restricted airspace here. We climb up. Once we get into Class A airspace, our COA approves us to go out into the remainder of the training airspace and the ATCAs that you see. So once we get up to here, we are cleared to maneuver to any of these other training airspaces out here, with a big key being R5203, which is the restricted area that's over Lake Ontario. All right, and that's where we can conduct the majority of our training, out over the water over that. All right, so what this leads into is the initiatives that we're trying to push for Hancock Field, and that is flight operations off of Syracuse. And why do we want to do this? The bottom line is it will help us increase our FTU production. They're increasing at 50% next year. There's talks that the next year after that, they want to double it after that, just to meet the need that's required. It'll also reduce the daily risk and the daily operational risk of traveling back and forth, and it'll also save over $1 million a year just in taxpayer money on that on the transportation costs and manpower costs. And lastly, and we think it's important, is we're a community-based organization. The Air National Guard is. And we stay in the community. We serve in the community. And it's important for us to get our message out on that we operate these, what we do, we operate them safely, and we gain the confidence in what our operations are. So that's another important aspect of why we want to do this. And to do this, you know, we are dealing with the FAA to get a COA and a certificate of approval in order for this to happen. And one of the messages that we have to get across is the first one we got was, hey, it's not safe. You're going into Class C airspace with all these airliners. Your safety record is terrible, all this other stuff. So we just have to combat that with some of factual data. So you have to be prepared for that. Some of the negative stuff that always continues to come out there is that, there's 49 drone crashes since 2001. This is serious, all that stuff. But if you take a look at the safety data that is performed by the Air Force on all platforms, we have a pretty good rate, 2.3 accidents per 1,000 hours. And, of course, since we're unmanned, and, fortunately when they have crashed, there's been nobody on the ground, we have zero fatalities. You compare that to general aviation, and that's just NTSB data from 2007 to 14. They have 6.6 accidents per 100,000 flying hours with 3,628 fatalities. So our safety record is good, and our 2.3 rate there is equitable with other manned aircraft in the United States Air Force as well. All right, so in January of 14, the FAA actually approached us at Hancock Field and said, hey, we want you to establish, and we want to partner together to establish flight operations out of Class C airspace, and we want you to be the first one. We said, great, we would love to do this, let's work forward. And we've gone an aggressive program to do that. In order to do that for the military, we had to do an environmental assessment. We had to get our spectrum analysis of the frequencies. We've accomplished all of that. And one of the big kickers also with the FAA is a sense of the void. So in order to operate until you get into restricted airspace, you have to have some type of sense of the void. So we're initially going to tackle that via probably a chase aircraft, all right? But then after that, that's not really efficient as well, and plus it's a money contract as well. We're looking at a ground-based sense and avoid solution. In fact, like I said, I'm special projects on that as well, and we've been looking forward to that and hope to begin testing on a ground-based sense and avoid hopefully in January of 16. So here locally, we've met all requirements except for this crazy little C-band frequency authorization. And this comes from the Department of Commerce, who controls those, and through a little bit of concern of the FAA. So you have all, in the FAA, you got all sorts of organizations, right? So you have the operations folks who have approved our COA. So we have an operational COA that says, yes, we understand where you're going to go. You guys can do this. But then on the other hand, you have the frequency folks there at the FAA, and they've chimed in and said, that's an unsecure link that can be jammed, and then once you guys jam, then you're an unguided missile that's going to be flying around in Class C airspace, end quote. So we're working our way through that with that. But I think some of the concerns also stem from the fact that the Air Force had promised a long time ago to get out of the C-band regime, because what is, again, as I've learned, is that everything is about money, right? So Department of Commerce controls the C-band frequency spectrum, and they want to sell that off to a lot of companies that are either starting up or mobile companies that are going to use that. So they want to sell those C-band frequencies off there. Well, guess what? The military is using them right now, and they're using them for free. So they're trying to get us out of that regime. The Air Force has been dragging their feet on that, so I think they're making a little bit of statement as well as going, hey, you guys got to expedite this. So we're working through that as well, and we're trying to get them come up with an interim solution. And bottom line is, yes, we realize we want to get out of the C-band regime, and we have to work into the KU band for line of sight. How does that relate to y'all? Again, as was discussed before, there's a whole lot of frequency spectrum management issues that are out there that are really not being discussed. It's expensive. Nobody's regulating it. Can you be jammed? That's a big concern of the FAA, is can it be jammed and then somebody else take it over and fly it or anything else like that? And what are the procedures that happen? So that is a huge concern that has to be out there and the Air Force is addressing. So the concept or operations for that, like I said, is we'll launch out of Hancock Field. Sorry, I'm going to go over on this side. Sorry. Launch out of Hancock Field, and initially via chase aircraft, it's going to follow us out into the restricted airspace there, and once we get into the restricted airspace, we'll climb on up, and then we'll have access in the ATCAs as before. What we're working for is a ground-based sense and avoid solution that will mitigate the requirement for a chase and give us basically file and fly capability to get to, again, the the airspace that we need to train in. All right, so we talked about concept for operations. It should be about 3 sorties a day. It'll be concurrent operations with civilian traffic. We squawk and talk just like any other aircraft. We're talking to the air traffic control tower. It's real-time response. We have an IFF. We respond to their vectoring requirements as required. It's just like any other aircraft. We're just not in it, and it's that sense and avoid that is the hang-up right now. But with the, either the chase or ground-based sense and avoid, that should do it. Okay, and we discussed before, we understand we're not going to be flying live or inert weapons off of Hancock Field. But what we really want is, like I said, a true file and fly, just like an MQ-9. So we want the ability to file a flight plan, take off from Hancock Field, and fly anywhere in the national airspace. In order to do that, like we said, you have to have a combination of probably ground-based sense and avoid and some type of airborne sense and avoid. All right, and we're working on both. Like I said, the ground-based sense and avoid, we should begin testing. It's already been approved by the Army for their Gray Eagle program. They are flying it. Now we're just trying to transition it to Air Force operations out of the Air National Guard, specifically to mobilize that so that we can use one of our another mission that the Guard uses, which is the support of domestic operations to support our governor, really. So in the Air National Guard, we both work federally. We work federally for the president, but we also work for the governor. So if their governor ever asks us to respond to any type of emergency or response, we can do that. And so we want that ability to do it. So we're trying to mobilize that so we can set up, say, a site over New York City after a hurricane rolls through, so that we can get down and then we can provide that video to the first responders to make sure that they are moving in the correct direction and to unify the operation. So those are two of the biggies that I'm working on are both flying out of Hancock Field and the ground-based sense and avoid, but there should also probably be an airborne sense and avoid capability as well, and that will truly allow you to fly in any airspace. With a ground-based sense and avoid, you're going to be tethered to that radar or whatever you're using. With an airborne sense and avoid solution, then you're going to be able to maneuver wherever, especially if you're talking and squawking to the ATC. The next is, as always, there's always a safety concern with that sense and avoid. There should be at some point in time the ability to develop some type of auto-collision avoidance. So you've got TCAS currently that's out there, if folks are familiar with that. There's something that should be developed as well for remotely piloted aircraft. And as we discussed already, is your command and control issues as far as your frequency spectrum and us moving out of the C-band frequency band. This is just a vision. This is Mike Smith's vision of what that would do and a ground-based sense and avoid laydown. If we could put a radar here to cover Syracuse, I think they're putting one, a new air is putting a test site here over at Rome. You can link those together. You put another one over here, and then you put another one up Fort Drum to cover their operations as well. Now, basically, you have a corridor that goes up to the ATCAs that you can operate freely with. Now, the key issue with this is integration of all those radars into a display that comes to the pilot that's operating it, and they can make decisions based off of the information that's coming to them. So that's a big data crunch that has to occur as well. So that's not an easy solution, but you know, if the architecture could be there to make that happen, that's where an airborne sense and avoid radar as well, I think, helps. All right, so that's kind of the projects that we're looking at locally that are kind of the short rocks. We're also interested in partnering with the Customs and Border Protection. Again, we talked about our ability to help. They fly an MQ-9 aircraft as well, so there's no reason that we shouldn't partner with them and team up our operations. It's like we said before, and especially with potentially sequestration, a continuing resolution, everybody's trying to save money. Especially in the federal government, there's no reason not to partner together to try to save money for organizations. Okay, as we discussed, civil support operations. for United States Air Force remotely piloted aircraft to operate with some domestic operations. The state has to request it, and then the Secretary of Defense has to approve it. All right, because we're in such high demand, they don't want to take away from the training and overseas operations, so the Secretary of Defense has to approve it. While the process has worked and it's been successful, that can be time-consuming, and sometimes folks don't ask for it because they don't want to go through the headache, is the bottom line. So I had too many. So, as I look at this crowd here, developing some type of system that's easy for the state and for responders to use and get the video back to the appropriate nodes is kind of critically important. And then last, and this is, again, Mike Smith speaking way out there, is integrating ourselves into the Homeland Defense mission that is already with some of the manned aircraft that are in the United States Air Force and how we're going to do that. And so the initiatives that we're moving forward with ground-based sense and avoid and airborne sense and avoid just lead into that operation as well. All right. This kind of leads into the civil support or whatever Homeland Defense operations. If you take off out of Syracuse, or really this is out of Fort Drum, we could fly over New York City and we can provide, 15-hour orbit over New York City, providing that full motion video support to the incident commander down there. Or you can go, as you can see, the timeline as it goes up and down the East Coast. So that's our ability, and again, that persistence in order to help. All right, I will open it up to any questions at this time.
Some clarification, please, on your C-band C2 issue. I'm not sure what part of the band you're talking about, because you know there's the allocated spectrum at the 5030 to 5091 protected spectrum that there, at least the standards groups are looking at right now. So
yeah, we right now operate in the 5200 to 5800 regime.
So are you considering moving down to, if you could stay in the C-band?
We're trying to move entirely out of the C-band spectrum.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you, and I hope I at least provided you a little bit of insight on how the Air Force uses RPAs and maybe some potential help on developing future remotely piloted or UAV operations.
Thank you for listening. Find more great content at theuavdigest.com.